Hello and welcome. This is Colleen O'Grady, the host of the Power Your Parenting Moms with Teens podcast. This is a gathering place for moms to be encouraged, nurtured, and inspired. Also, you'll learn the latest in teen research and trends and get practical parenting tips. You really can improve your relationship with your teen and enjoy the teenage years.
Welcome back, everyone, to the 110th episode of Power Your Parenting Moms with Teens podcast. And I'm Colleen O'Grady, the host of the show. In this episode, I interview Kristen Van Ogtrop. Kristen is the author of Just Let Me Lie Down, Necessary Terms for the Half-Insane Working Mom, the former longtime editor-in-chief of Real Simple, and the amateur columnist for Time. She is a literary agent at Inkwell Management. Her writing has appeared in countless publications and the New York Times bestselling collection, The Bitch in the House. She is a wife and mother of three, but sometimes loves her dogs more than anybody else. Kristen just released her new book, Did I Say That Out Loud? Midlife Indignities and How to Survive Them. Kristen is a very gifted writer. And to be a gifted writer, you have to pay attention and name things that we haven't quite named yet, and thus the title, Did I Say That Out Loud? She does address some of the challenges of those middle years, but in a way that is so real and poignant, hilarious, and optimistic all at the same time. There were many times that I was reading her book that I was literally laughing out loud, and my neighbors would have thought I had just lost it. I think it's such a gift when someone can help you laugh at yourself and not take your life, your parenting, your future so seriously, to reevaluate what's the point of it all, to not try to be so perfect and just take yourself lightly. So welcome, Kristen.
Oh, Colleen, it's really nice to talk to you.
And I really appreciate your time, and I know my moms are going to love you.
Oh, yeah, well, okay, setting the bar super high, but I'll do my best.
All right. So you have a book that just came out called Did I Say That Out Loud? Midwife. Okay, I'm going to say that again.
That's my next book, Midwife Indignities. That would actually be a more interesting book, probably.
Okay. All righty. We'll try that again. Can you tell me what the name of your book is?
Yes. It's called Did I Say That Out Loud? Midlife Indignities and How to Survive Them.
Well, I can tell you, I love your book. It's poignant, it's funny, and again, like a great credit for your book is when I laugh out loud, and I laughed out loud quite a bit in your book. Oh, so okay. Can you tell me, what was the inspiration behind that book? Or why did you write it?
Well, it's sort of like a multi-layered answer. I mean, why I wrote this book and why I wrote my first book, which came out a long time ago in 2010, which was like a humor book for working moms, was really born out of my experience running this big consumer magazine, Real Simple, where I would write in my monthly editor's letter, I would always write about something, I mean, I think 95% of the time that was in the magazine that month, but I tried to relate it to something in my life. Because I felt like it was my job in that role to kind of, to reflect the life of the reader. And so I would sort of tell stories and about like, you know, I mean, you know, you're a mom and your listeners are moms. Many times about my life as a mom or a homeowner or a pet owner or a woman inhabiting a body in America. And readers would write in and say, oh, I feel like you're my friend. And oh my gosh, that exact same thing happened to me. I mean, sometimes there were haters, but most of the time it was women who felt like we are traveling the same path. And I love to write. You know, I felt compelled, I guess, to keep telling stories that I felt like a lot of people, women like me, of which there are millions, could relate to and feel either amused by, as you comforted by, or it's always nice to feel like you're part of a community, right? And maybe it's a community of people who just read a book who you will never meet. But this book in particular, you know, there's so much about the middle part of life that just sucks. I mean, I had this experience, well, I write about it in the book. The first chapter of the book is about this experience I had where I was hospitalized for a week. And then, you know, like 2 weeks ago, my middle son broke his ankle and I had to take him to the hospital. And I realized a few years ago that I never have a good reason to go to the hospital anymore. you know, like when you're childbearing age, hospitals are like fantastic because you're usually going to a hospital to have a baby. And now you only go to the hospital for bad things. And so it's just stuff like that. You know, like there's so much about midlife that's like not great. And I wanted to write a book that felt the opposite of that. Yeah. You know, that acknowledge the things that are just stupid, like all the indignities in the subtitle of the book, but that also had at its heart an optimistic outlook.
Let's talk about your chapter, Don't Make Me Rate You, which I thought was funny.
Yeah. I mean, it started out, I tell this story about how I was going to this event back when I was a corporate citizen, and I had to, it was actually the Time 100 dinner, which is really great. I worked as part of Time Inc. And every year there was this big event where just like super famous, fabulous people came to this event. And even though no one was going to be looking at me, I still went and got a blowout. And so when I got back from Dry Bar, are there dry bars everywhere? Or is it like a New York thing? Do you have Dry Bar?
Yeah, we do. We do in Houston.
So I went to Dry Bar and, you know, I looked better than my normal self. I didn't look amazing. And when I got back to my office, there was this email from Dry Bar asking me to rate my experience. And that just like something set me off there. I was listening to your podcast episode about space and how we need space. And I've thought about it a lot since I listened to that episode, because there's so much that is in my little phone that keeps me from having space. And this thing is in my back pocket, like 90% of my waking hours. I mean, literally in the back pocket of my pants, since I'm wearing jeans all the time now working from home in the pandemic. And, you know, the stuff I talk about in Don't Make Me Rate You is how now everything we do has to be documented on social media and then hopefully liked by everyone you've ever met who follows you on social media, or you get an email from the company, or you have to sort of log into something to rate your experience. And it's such a time suck.
It is. Yeah. And that's just the thing about this culture. Like, we didn't do that years ago.
No.
It's crazy.
You know, when you say things like we didn't do that years ago, like I say what you just said, like we didn't used to do that. And then I feel like I'm 100 because that's like such a 100-year-old lady thing to say. I don't know. It was better, I think, when we didn't have to rate Dry Bar just to go there. Or it was easier. Let's put it that way. Life was less complicated when we didn't have to rate so many things. There was more time for other things.
Yes. All right. So then you have a chapter called I Can Smell My Pillow. Mm-hmm. And you talked about estrogen. And then you kind of went on a rant around sleep.
Yeah. Well, the reason that chapter is called I Can Smell My Pillow is because my grandmother, my paternal grandmother, who was Dutch, used to say in Dutch, I can smell my pillow, when she was having a dinner party and she wanted people to leave. So now it just, for some reason, when I'm really tired, I think of I can smell my pillow. It's a longing for bed. I've never used it on dinner party guests. maybe in Dutch, in the original Dutch, it has more of a clear impact or something, or culturally the Dutch understand when you say, I can smell my pillow, it's time to leave. You know, when I first started talking about writing this book with my editor, Tracy Behar at Little Brown, who said, really, I couldn't ask for a better editor. We were standing at a bar. We were at the Christmas party for the literary agency I worked for. And one of her colleagues was there. I said, you know, I've got this idea for a book. And what came to me was the subtitle, Midlife Indignities and How to Survive Them. And her colleague was standing next to her and she leaned in and she said, well, you have to write about insomnia. You know, insomnia is one of those stinky things. There's certainly younger people who suffer from insomnia, but it's such a sneaky thing because some nights it just gets you and then the next night it doesn't, and you don't really know why. So that chapter is certainly about that, but it's about estrogen, it's about my thyroid, it's about the various things in your life that contribute at this time of life to not being able to sleep, including a long list of worries, you know, that you didn't have
right
when you were 25, if you were a lucky person, which I was and still am. You know, your list of responsibilities grows, and with it your list of worries.
Yeah.
And so the sleepless nights are not far behind.
Well, how you wrote it was hilarious, because I think a lot of moms can relate to that. It's like 3:05, I was worrying about, you know, this, and 3:08, then I was worrying about that. That whole long list of things that you haven't been able to process during the day all kind of come out at 3 a.m.
Oh yeah. It's the most bananas thing. And I'm sure there's some scientific reason, but I do my most aggressive worrying probably between 3 and 4:30 in the morning, you know? And then like you fall back asleep eventually, if you're lucky. I usually fall back asleep. And then I wake up at like 6:30 and I'm not worried anymore. And it's like, okay, so why did that? Is it because it's dark? Is it because I'm well rested kind of for a minute? Like, why do you worry so much in the middle of the night? And then you wake up and you're not that worried. Does that happen to you?
Yeah. I mean, it feels life and death at 3 a.m. And then you're like, well, that wasn't a big deal. Yeah.
So what is that though?
I don't know. What I do think is that we don't have enough downtime right now. Mm. And a lot of times our downtime is we reach for the phone, which is still input. So our brain never has the space to process the day.
Right.
So the first time it has time to really process things is at 3 a.m.
Yeah. The crazy thing about the middle of the night worrying is, for me at least, every worry is exactly the same size. And one worry might be, when is anybody going to call the mechanic to get the snow tires taken off the car?
Uh-huh.
Which rests right alongside, is my son going to get into the law school he wants to get into? Okay, and those are like two really different, in terms of size, life impact, you know, but they look exactly the same in my head at 3:30 in the morning. Okay, so what is that? I don't know what that is.
Oh either. My gosh, I don't know either. That's funny. That's true. It's very, very true. All right, so you talk about those three phases of parenthood, which was funny.
Well, okay, so, and there may be more than three, but in my mind, I've only experienced three, and my oldest son is 20, almost 26. I'm sure there are more phases, but until your kid is 26, I think there are three. So the first phase is your child will be everything you ever dreamed. You know, this child will be a spectacular human being in the history of the world.
Mm-hmm.
Everything your child does is amazing,
mm-hmm.
and looks like it's leading to something incredible, right? That's phase one. Then phase two is your child disappoints you.
Yes.
And that's when you realize that your child is probably not going to become a Division I athlete or get a full scholarship to Juilliard just because they practice the piano like once a week or become the next like Mark Zuckerberg. So then there's a phase where you realize that your child is really average. But I mean average in ultimately a good way. Like your child is normal. You have a normal child. You have a not extraordinary child. You have a wonderful, normal child.
Right.
And then the third phase is your children make you disappointed in yourself. And that's the phase where you realize you're a bad person. I'm oversimplifying. That's the phase where you realize that these children who are normal, who you brought into the world, are amazing people who in a lot of ways are better people than you are. Both for some like daily reasons, like they know how to find Netflix on the remote, you know, I can't, whatever. Like that's, I mean, a bit of a cliche at this point, but my relationship with my TV remote is very fraught. But then they're also just generous and not judgy and really wonderful people. And as they get older, on certain days, and I write about this in kind of a long passage in the book, you start to feel very sad. I think as a mom, when my kids were little, I spent a lot of time waiting for them to get older. mm-hmm. you know, like, and longing for more space and more free time and more independence from the job of mothering. And then when you start to get that, you realize, oh, I don't actually think that's so great. Like, what I write about in the book is, for me, it started to happen when my youngest son, who's now 14, was entering seventh grade. And for some reason, I was still on the email list from the elementary school with all the super exciting back to school information for like second graders who still love their mothers and want to walk to school holding hands and stuff. And your child is 12 and really, in an age appropriate way, changing and pulling away from you. And it just made, I mean, for me, it just was like a gut punch whenever I would get those emails.
I'm actually writing a book right now for mothers of daughters 18 to 25. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the maneuvering that I don't think we talk about enough, because it's a whole lot of feelings that we go through as moms. And yeah. there is sadness, and then there's joy, sometimes the same moment.
Yeah.
It's complicated.
Well, isn't that when girls start to get really great again? Aren't they really awful? I'm speaking from zero experience here. Like, isn't that when having a girl is like so spectacular again? I wouldn't know. But it's something I sort of fantasize about.
Wouldn't it be wonderful if it was that black and white?
Yes. This is why you're a therapist and I'm not a therapist. Because I think it should be.
There are definitely a lot of spectacular moments. But the whole point of this book is those brains aren't fully developed till 25. So they're going to keep making pretty immature decisions.
Yeah.
And yet they're out of your reach. So that's a whole new level of stuff.
I think that's true for boys too.
Yeah. Absolutely. All right. So I laughed when you, on your chapter of Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Snapchat, because I'm with you. Like, I got Facebook, I get Twitter, I get Instagram. But Snapchat was just kind of the line in the sand.
Yeah. I gave up. I gave up completely on Snapchat. I tried it for like a minute. And, you know, there are people I work with and my children, obviously, who use TikTok, mm-hmm. which I kind of put in the Snapchat bin in my brain, like something that's obviously super important in our culture right now. And just not, I feel comfortable opting out. I don't know. I think that for someone my age, which is almost 57, I think if you're really good at one social media platform, good for you. Like, that's great. And so I feel like I'm really good at Instagram, and the others I'm just not as good at. And I just think, you know what? Being good at one is good. That's good enough. So I think we need to forgive ourselves. We're not, you know, we're not 19. I'll never be good at TikTok. So I'm not going to try to be good at TikTok or Snapchat.
Right. I think that's a great philosophy. And then you have a chapter called Friends 100%. Mm. And I laugh because you're right. Who started 100%?
Oh.
Can you talk about that?
Well, I don't write about this in the book, but I went out to lunch. This is before the pandemic, when we were going out to lunch in Midtown Manhattan with an old work colleague. And the waiter came up and like he took our order, but then he started asking us questions about like what it was a Friday, like what we were doing for the weekend and stuff. And like everything we said, his answer was 100%. And I thought, do you not know how to say yes, you know, or I understand you, or that's interesting. It was like his response to everything was 100%. So the reason that chapter is called Friends 100% is it opens with a book club meeting. And my book club is really central to that chapter. And you know, my book club is a collection of eight other women. We're nine of us who we have been together as a book club for more than 20 years. And, wow. You know, we meet every month or 6 weeks, and it's a really important. And of course we like hardly talk about the book. Well, it depends on the book. Actually, some books we talk about a lot. One of my book club friends, Sylvia, went on a rant one night about 100%. Like, why does everyone say 100% to everything? And, but then as I write about in the chapter, it, you know, what the book club represents to me is friendship 100%. That chapter is sort of a long exploration, I guess, of friendship in middle age and beginning with how when you're young, it's so much easier to make friends than it is when you get older. And so when you have those friendships, once you reach a certain age, that are enduring, it's almost like they crystallize into something that's really hard and beautiful. You know, it's like a diamond. They become a diamond eventually. And so they're just so key to sort of how you interpret the world, really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank God for our friends.
Yeah. And I write about this in the chapter, like, I don't think I'm that great at friendship. I think about the amount of time I spend on friendships. It's definitely not as much as a lot of other people I know. You know, I think when we get busy and if you have kids and you have a job, and it's just friendships are something that are easy to overlook. And so I don't think I'm great at friendship.
Well, I think you're normal. And I think like what you just talked about is we have so many things pulling at us at this stage of life. And we don't even realize we haven't seen our best friend in 2 months. Mm-hmm. Like life gets so busy. But I think just calling to mind and just talking about like the stabilizing factor of our friendships, and that we can laugh about absurd things and talk about real things and be ourselves it's such a high priority. It's like just a reminder to all of us to prioritize our friends.
Yeah. Well, and I think in this way, going back to social media, I think social media can really work against us. Mm-hmm. You know, I've got this dear, dear longtime friend who I mentioned a couple of times in the book. Her name is Mary Lewis. She actually introduced me and my husband, who I've been married to for a long time now. And, you know, I follow Mary Lewis on Instagram. She follows me on Instagram. We used to vacation together every summer with our families. And, you know, like she'll post something and I'll comment, or I'll like it and I'll post something and she'll comment. And I think there's something that happens where you think that that's like interacting, mm-hmm. you know, but it's not. But I think that our brains have been tricked to think, oh, well, that counts for something. And I'm not sure it counts for anything.
Yeah, no, I agree. Good point.
Yeah, it counts for a little something, but it's not the same as picking up the phone and talking to that person on the phone.
Absolutely.
Or taking a walk or something.
Yes. Making the effort to sit in a room with your friends.
Yeah. Which we can do once we are not in a pandemic anymore. Hopefully.
Yeah. Pandemic doesn't help that.
No.
For sure.
No.
All right. So your chapter, Things Fall Apart. I was sitting in my backyard laughing like a crazy woman. So...
Well,
especially the abdomen in all caps.
Oh, yeah. I think that that's actually, there's probably something disordered in my thinking that is, that controls my abdomen, and the state of my abdomen controls how I feel about my day. You know, instead of bad hair days, I have like bad abdomen days. I mean, it starts out with a lot about my abdomen, talking about how one day I knocked my toenail of my big toe against my other foot and my toenail broke in half. And I was like, are you kidding me? Like it was like, I'm just throwing in the towel. Like if I hit my toenail against my other foot and it breaks in half, there's like something seriously wrong with the whole system. But anyway, so then I start talking about, you know, my core, the absence of core strength, I guess, and the abdomen. But it really, what the chapter then turns into, as you know, is sort of like a chapter about deferred maintenance, I guess.
Yes.
And how maintenance is not something that I'm very good at and my husband's very good at. And, you know, when it comes to certain types of, or certain parts of our lives, like our cars, we're not so good at maintenance. And then there's maintenance that you put off, like root canal, like tooth pain, because it creates this domino effect of like a million other than dental appointments. So I'm still really unresolved about the things falling apart. When it's right to ignore something and when you have to like lean in and really try to fix something. I don't know the answer.
Yes. I am very annoyed at maintenance, the personal maintenance thing. And one of your chapters, you talked about effortless beauty. Mm-hmm. And like, yeah, when I was in my 20s, like I would roll out of bed, no makeup, just so easy. with my hair, yeah. all of that. And now everything is like an ordeal, like your teeth, you got to spend a ton of time on that, and your face and your neck and your, it's just crazy. There's so much maintenance, and yeah. it's just, it's true. It's true. And having a daughter, I know you have sons, but the thing about the daughter is that it's like a daily reminder of how she has no maintenance.
Oh yeah. yeah. Well, and I write about this in the book, where the day after I had a colonoscopy, I went to lunch duty at my son's then elementary school. And I was talking to his perfect, perfect teacher, Mrs. Rossi, who, as I write about in the book, he was deeply in love with when he was in second grade and wanted to marry, I think. I had these real pains in my midsection from the colonoscopy. No one had warned me about that part, about the after sensations. And so as I was talking to her in the lunchroom at the school, I was hinging over and over and over, because like gripping my side, because I thought, I don't know what's happening down there, but it's probably not great. And she was looking at me like, what is wrong with you? Because she's 29. She was at the time 29 years old. Like, she had no idea. And when I said to her, oh, I had a colonoscopy yesterday, she looked at me like, what's a colonoscopy? She didn't say that. I mean, she knows what a colonoscopy is, but it was so far from her reality. She's a wonderful person. I write about her a couple times in the book, and I sent her the chapters where I write about her, because I use her real name, and I really wanted to get her blessing.
Yes.
She claims not to remember my post-colonoscopy lunch duty day, but it is seared in my memory.
Oh my goodness. The way you write about that was hilarious. Very hilarious. And then the number 11 was also something that I laughed very, I had no idea where that was going. Yeah. So could you tell these moms about the number 11?
Well, so when you have 11s, it's the two little vertical frown lines at the bridge of your nose. And in my family, the frown, we don't have like resting bitch face. We have resting frown, all of us, everyone in my family. And we all look a little bit either angry or confused, I guess, depending on like the angle of the sun. And so I was having this potluck party at my house for our new neighbors. We live in a block in suburban New York. And so there are probably 10 houses on our block, maybe. Maybe a third of them had kind of turned over in the last year. And so I thought, oh, wouldn't it be fun if we all got together and we'll have the potluck dinner. And it was in the winter. And it was a mix of like neighbors that I know pretty well and neighbors that I really don't know at all. And I was carrying a platter of food to the dining room, and this one neighbor kind of grabbed my arm, and she was like, are you okay? And I realized, like, I was totally fine, but I had my like resting frown face with my 11s above the bridge of my nose. And that's just my face. It's just my face. In fact, that was, we were going to call this book, I'm Not Tired, or either I'm Not Tired or I'm Not Angry. It's Just My Face. But it just seemed to I don't know, like cosmetic and not broad enough or something. But maybe that doesn't happen to you. My kids will say to me, Mom, you look so sad. And I'll be like, what are you talking about? Just my face.
Well, this thing, you know, with the lips and it just looks like you're sad the whole time.
I know. The lips start to go down. I know. Yeah. It's just really, what are you going to do?
Well, I think laughing about it is a great thing to do. I think that's
you have to.
So you have been married 29 years. Mm-hmm. And can you share some of your thoughts about marriage?
Oh, man. How much time you got? Right. So my husband and I met when I was a senior in college, and I feel really lucky. You know, I feel so lucky. Like, I don't know. Now that I have two kids in their 20s, and I think, oh, how do you find your person? Anyway, we were introduced to mutual friends, and you know, I think that, and I write about this a little bit in the book. I mean, I think when you're married, and you're happy enough, meaning no one has become horrible. You've been faithful to each other, at least as far as you know. You know, you have built a life together that is comfortable enough. I sort of feel like you wake up every day and you say, okay, like, I'm going to choose to stay married to this person. I mean, you don't consciously say it. And I also think that the one benefit of, I mean, my husband and I will be married 30 years in June, which is just sounds so crazy even to say. It seems so long, you know? And since I'm so young, that's a really long time. I think the one benefit of being in a relationship, whether it's a marriage or just a committed relationship that lasts that long, is you begin to understand the stuff that you can just sort of ignore. Mm-hmm. You know, I feel like what was hard for me, at least in early marriage, was thinking, I need to work hard to mold this person to be exactly the person that fits me, who P.S. doesn't exist, right? But when you're 30 or 25 or whatever, for me at least.
Right.
And I think by this point, you or I, and I saw this in my parents' marriage too. I mean, my parents are still married. They've been married for 57 years, maybe 58 years. Is you just like the stuff that bugs you, you just say, I'm just not even going to hear this. Or I'm not going to pay attention to it. I'm not going to worry about it. It's the thing that bugs me and it's not fatal. It's sort of like, I was saying this to a friend the other day, you know, I've got these two sons in their 20s and I've got, my youngest is 14, as I told you. And he's a great kid, but he's entering that time of teenagehood where he's kind of a jerk, you know, like he's a really nice kid, but he's becoming a little bit of a jerk, just as his brothers did. And then they pass through that. It goes back to what I was saying about girls. Like, isn't that the point where girls get good again? Like, so I look at his behavior sometimes now and I think, ugh, it's like the teenage thing. And I'm just going to like ignore it unless I really need to do something because he's doing something dangerous or whatever. And I know he'll pass through this. And so I think that for me, at least, the longer I've been married, the more patient I've become with things that are irritating.
I think that is good wisdom right there.
I don't know. It's what has worked for me.
No, I think it is because there's so many huge things. But I liked what you said, or all the inside jokes that you've stored up with your husband for 30 years.
Yeah. I mean, we do have, I write about this in the book, right? So I write sort of tongue in cheek in the book that part of the reason we can never get divorced is there's just like too much in the bank in terms of inside jokes for over so many years. But we live in this town, this suburban New York town in Westchester County, and we've lived in this town for 25 years, I guess. You know, there are people in the town who we don't actually know, but we've kind of turned into characters. And then we give them names and we talk about them to each other. Like, oh, there's so-and-so. Oh my gosh, guess what I saw him do today? And these are all people we have no idea who they are in real life, you know? And a friend of mine who's a novelist who lives in our town read an early copy of my book. And she wanted to know who all the people, like I call them in the book, like the dork and running lady and the explorer. Like these are all the names that Dean, my husband, and I use for them. And my friend Karen was like, who is when Perfect Family was one? She's like, who's Perfect Family? And I was like, I'm not going to tell you who Perfect Family is. Like, that's a violation of my marital vows if I told you who Perfect Family was.
I love it. All right. So then you have a chapter called Dear Searching, and you have your 8-step plan to finding meaning in the days ahead.
Yeah. So Dear Searching, it's one of the last chapters in the book. So I started writing this book in probably the beginning of 2017. At the end of 2016, I was a magazine editor for 25 years, and it was a really, really great career. And as I write about in the book, that career ended in 2016. The magazine industry had really changed, and the guy had changed. And I had the incredible luxury of being able to leave a job without another job. I mean, I did have a severance package, so that helped. But I had all these ideas in my mind of, you know, so for a long time, I was Kristen Van Ogtrop, magazine editor, cog in this giant corporate machine person. I thought, well, maybe all along, I have these other destinies that were really what I was supposed to be doing. Mm-hmm. So I took 2 years off. And in those 2 years, I tried some of the, I tried, that, which is a ridiculous thing to say when, now that I say it out loud, but like I was a stay-at-home mom to my youngest son. My older guys were out of the house, but you know, the youngest guy was in fourth grade. And so I would like walk him to school every day and pick him up every day and made dinner every night and did all of these things that my mom did without giving him much, you know, without sort of any kind of intention. I was raised by a stay-at-home mom. I had a really happy childhood. She was a really good mom, still is a really good mom. She graduated from college. She was a teacher for like a minute. She started having babies and then she became a stay-at-home mom. And she was like an A++++ stay-at-home mom. So I decided I was going to try that. and it was, you know, I was an A+. I wasn't like a monster, but as it turns out, this isn't the path I was supposed to be on for 25 years. So good. Like I know that now. I worked for a nonprofit, first volunteering and then doing some consulting work. Because I thought maybe I should be a nonprofit person. I think I realized too, okay, that's good. That wasn't my destiny either. But the reason Dear Searching is told in these sort of eight different steps to try is it kind of mirrors the different things that I did and tried in the 2 years when I was in between jobs. Well, toward the end, I guess, ends with the moment, which was in the solar eclipse in August of 2017, when I realized I really missed being in an office. I was with my son, my youngest son, Axel, and his friend Jackson. And I was really excited about the solar eclipse. I couldn't really get them excited about it. Like we made the thing out of the cereal box and the tin foil where you can look at it or whatever. And then I realized, you know, if I were in my office still working with like 40 other people, we would be talking about a solar eclipse all day long. It would be such a thing. And I miss like being in an office and talking about the solar eclipse. And then I thought, oh my gosh, Kristen, you need to go be around a group of adults again. That's where you belong. I mean, I write about this in a couple of chapters in the book, being of a certain age and having a career that is no longer a certainty, either because you're like, bored or you no longer find meaning in what you're doing or your industry changes. And, you know, when I think about my friends who are my age, I don't know a lot of women in their 50s who are really, really happy in their jobs. I just don't. And that's kind of a tough place to be.
Well, I think the eight things that you mentioned are helpful.
Oh, well, thank you.
Yeah. So anything else that you would like to share with the moms who are listening before we wind up?
I think I've shared a lot. What I hope people, moms and other and non-moms experience when they read my book is this feeling that like things go wrong, but it's all going to be okay in the end. I think that moms are so hard on themselves.
Yeah.
A long time ago, there was an article in the New Yorker about good enough parenting. Mm-hmm. And the difference between terrible parenting and good enough parenting is pretty big. I mean, you know, you would know this better than I do. You're a therapist. But the difference between good enough parenting and extraordinary parenting is not as big. And that for a lot of kids, good enough parenting is really good enough. And I thought about that. I read that article when my two older boys were really little. And I've thought about it a lot because on the days when I just feel like I'm not the A++++ mom that my mom was, you know, I'm good enough. And I think probably most of the people who listen to your podcast I'm sure you have extraordinary moms who listen to your podcast, but I bet there are a ton of good enough moms. Mm-hmm. And I just hope that they know that about themselves, that good enough is often good enough.
Well, what your book does that you may not be aware of this is I think there's such a pressure on moms to be perfectionists that your book is helping moms take themselves lightly. And that's a huge gift and not feel that pressure.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
I guess I didn't set out to do that, but if that is an end result, that makes me really happy.
Yeah, it does. It does. Well, thank you, Kristen, for your time. I really appreciate it.
Well, it's been a real pleasure being on your podcast and thank you for having me here.
You're welcome. This concludes this week's episode of Power Your Parenting Moms with Teens podcast. If this podcast has been helpful, I would absolutely love it if you could go to Apple Podcasts and give Power Your Parenting Moms with Teens podcast a 5-star review. This makes it easier for other moms like you to find the support and encouragement they need. Also, my best-selling and award-winning book, Dial Down the Drama, Reducing Conflict, Reconnecting with Your Teenage Daughter, A Guide for Mothers Everywhere. You can find that and order it online at Amazon and Barnes & Noble. And you can always find other great resources and contact me at ColleenO'Grady.com, 2 L's and 2 E's.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.